track session number 12502, reel 12.
Field Marshal Bramwell, reel 12. You were telling me about your deployment role in Jacqueline.
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say we'd have done any of these things in war, but it was the options that they wanted us to practice to defend in the quite defensible country in Schleswig-Holstein, or on the Kiel Canal, or on the narrow neck that leads up into Jutland. But another role we had was quite differently on Zeeland, of course, where there was thought that an amphibious party might be landed to move directly on Copenhagen. And here was an area which we were sent to support the Danish forces and the Home Guard in defending the southern part of Zeeland. So we practiced all these things.
Was the terrain in Zeeland different to the terrain in Jutland?
Oh, yes, very much. I mean, Jutland was very good defensive country. I mean, it was much closer country. Zeeland was much more open. But there were quite a lot of big bridges which had all been prepared for demolition from the island of Mon and these other islands which lead into Zeeland. But it was much more open country now.
What impression did you get of the Danish army when you were operating with them?
I think the Danish senior officers were quite good. But, I mean, you know, they were wildly inexperienced. They'd not really had any sort of practical experience. Their troops, they were all conscripts. They looked a bit odd, looked a bit like the cast of Jesus Christ Superstar when they got out of the when they got out of their vehicles. But they had some good stalwart Home Guard chaps who would have done their best. But it was much more really to give sort of confidence to the Danish population, make them feel part of NATO. And it would have been a deployment, one hopes, to indicate that NATO was interested in that particular part.
So it's a matter of reassurance and deterrence.
I would have thought mostly. I mean, our artillery was limited, our tanks were limited. We had an airborne brigade on fairly light scales. It would depend what would have been thrown at us, but it was... it wouldn't have, and we would have been able to put up some resistance, but for how long, I'm not sure.
In the case of Zeeland, I understand that the main threat eventually was supposed to come from hovercraft, military air cushion vehicles, which could have...
Well, you mean up the Baltic?
Up the Baltic, well, and certainly across the marshy...
Well, I mean, one wouldn't have been alone, one would have got the Air Force onto this, and, if they were hovercraft, mines wouldn't have probably done very much good. But I know that Baltic area because I've sailed around in it, and it's fascinating. But I mean, of course, if they put a very heavy amphibious thing in, it might have been quite difficult to resist for very long.
Did you ever cooperate with the Danish Navy as part of your exercises in Zeeland or Jutland?
No. What I did do was I had in my brigade, or rather in addition to my brigade, I had and I was responsible for training them, the Allied Mobile Force Land. And so I used to go and visit it in Norway and go on exercises with it around Bergen and up in the mountains, around Voss. So that was my responsibility too. So I had quite a lot to do with the Norwegian army.
Oh. And how did they compare?
Oh, well, the Norwegian army in their own particular environment, extremely tough lot, I think. Very good I remember being attacked in the middle of the night. I was with the Coldstream Guards, who were RAMF, and we were attacked by the Norwegian cadet officer corps who ski in moonlight, skiing down the mountainside with no sticks and firing blank Tommy guns as they came storming down the mountainside. It was a very impressive sight. Somebody threw a thunder flare. We were all encamped round in tents because of the tents cold, about 30 degrees below. And I remember in the course of the battle, a thunder flash landed on the... I mean, I was outside it at the time, but it landed on my tent, blew a hole through both bits of the tent, and I remember spending the rest of the night extremely uncomfortable with no real shelter at all.
And was this the first time you'd had to actually act in collaboration with German troops when you were deployed into Schleswig?
In cooperation with German troops, yes, I suppose it was, yes. We saw something of the new Bundeswehr when I was in Berlin and came down to take part in exercises around Sennelager, but we weren't particularly cooperating with them. We were just in the same sort of general area as them, so I suppose it was. And, of course, I always found dealing with the Bundeswehr, I mean, their officers were, and divisional commanders were extremely experienced people, and they were very efficient. And I found this even more when I was commanding a division and worked closely with the 1st Panzer Grenadier Division and the 2nd Panzer Division, and I got to know them very well. But we'll come on to that later.
If it had actually come to fighting, what would the 5th Brigade have actually done in Jutland or Zeeland? Would it have acted as a mobile reserve to counterattack against penetrations, or would it have been engaged in positional defence? Because one presumes it would have been deployed.
Well, I would have much preferred to have seen it, of course, in Schleswig, because I thought that we could have had a task much more consistent with our capabilities and part of a larger force. And I thought that we in the 6th German Division and Danish Division as well could have, in that sort of country, could have put up quite a lot of resistance. I would have been happy to see that. Zealand, as I say, was extremely open and not such an easy task. But for deterrent purposes, we had to be seen to be in both places.
So I think the Danish Jutland Division was eventually equipped with German weapons and material, whereas the Zealand Division held on to its Centurions and kept its British equipment.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
If we can move on down to the IDC, the Imperial Defence College, as I believe it was in those days. I think you went there in 1970. Was that in 1 year?
Yes, that was 1 year, and it was rather interesting because it was interesting for two reasons. First of all, it was the last course of the Imperial Defence College. So I'm the last generation to have IDC after my name as opposed to RCDS. And secondly, for the first time for quite some time, we had a civilian commandant, Alistair Buchan. There had been one once before, a man called Scott, who was a famous proconsul in Southeast Asia. But he was of the same sort of mould, so to speak. I mean, he was a colonial servant, administrator, governor, that sort of thing. This is the first time we'd had an undiluted academic. And this was Alistair Buchan, of course, who was a great strategic analyst and nephew of the writer John Buchan. I think he was nephew. He might have been son, but I think he was nephew. Not sure. And a man very well thought of, I think, in the academic world, but a little out of touch with the military world. And I think it was very good for us because he tried to get a more of an academic content into the whole of this question. As a result, he got some very distinguished lecturers who came because he was there. I think he was a bit tactless in the way he went about it, because not all the military, wherever they came from, and they came from all over the world, were Philistines. But he tended to say, look, you are all Philistines. You can't write two coherent sentences together. I'm really going to sort you out, and your whole future careers will depend on the academic quality of the thesis that you write, and which I am now going to introduce. Well, this, of course, didn't endear himself to some of the people. But having said that, I think most people recognise that he brought new qualities to the instruction, which were probably quite badly needed. Anyhow, I was the first of the guinea pigs, and I had to write my thesis, which caused terrible confusion amongst some of the overseas students who'd come really to have quite a good time and play a lot of golf, and they were found they had to get down to it and write a thesis, which they didn't all enjoy. But I wrote this thesis, which was called, once again, The Application of Force. But unlike that one, which dealt with the tactical battle, this really dealt with the whole philosophy of force and conflict and strategy. And it was called The Application of Force of the 70s. And I like to think that if you change 70s for 80s, and possibly even with a bit of artistic license, change 70s for 90s, you wouldn't be really very far off. And this was my thesis. My tutor was Michael Howard, because we each had a tutor who corrected the thesis and gave one general sort of things on it. And this was published together with certain others in the Seaford House papers of that particular year. And
how many students were there on the course?
I think 60. But not, of course, I mean, they came from all over. And each year, of course, they extend to those who got them. Certainly we had a lot of Americans, Indians, Pakistanis. We didn't have any Eastern Europeans, I don't think, then.
You mentioned having lectures. What other methods of teaching?
Seminars, really, Alistair Buchan brought in. Before, it used to be a very leisurely course. It started about 10:30 and got away about 3 in the afternoon. And it was nearly all built round the formal lecture, which took place at about 11 o'clock and went on till lunchtime. But he then introduced seminars and people to come in and take seminars. And then, of course, we went on a tour. And I actually, funnily enough, went I might have gone on all sorts of tours, but I actually went on the UK-Scandinavian. Well, it was the Scandinavian seminar that I went on, and Northern Europe, Scandinavia, but it had UK put onto it. And so we went down a coal mine, and we went to Jodrell Bank, and we went to Rolls-Royce, and we went to a whole lot of things like that, which otherwise we might not have seen. And then the next year, before I went to command my division, I was brought back to run the North American tour for the RCDS, and I took the group round Canada and America. I found it very interesting. I found a year a little bit long, actually. I mean, it's very nice to have a bit of a sabbatical, but I found that a year doing nothing practical other than write your thesis was rather excessively long.
Did you have to write essays as well as the thesis?
No, that was the only thing we had to do.
You had to write. And what sort of syllabus did you follow then in the seminars?
Well, the whole course was divided into two sections. and you know, one dealt with the Cold War, and one dealt with different areas of the world, and so on. And you had seminars built around these things. One dealt with the industrial and economic base, and you know, they dealt with a wide variety of things. But we had seminars on all these things. But you see, I had 2 years really kicking my heels, because I finished this brigade at the end of 69. I was the IDC 70. 71, I was put on the, as number two, to the Stainforth Committee, reorganising the whole of the United Kingdom Land Forces into more or less autonomous districts, which has really stood the test up to now, when they are simplifying the districts yet again. And which I found interesting when I subsequently went back to CNC UKLF, and then at the end of that time I took the RCDS tour to North America, and I didn't go to my division until the end of 71.
When you were writing the thesis, did you choose the subject? Or
yes, entirely. It was very difficult to know what to do. And I say it, although it's got the same title as that, of course it dealt with a completely different area. This was really the philosophy and realities of modern conflict, as opposed to the sort of battlefield side.
Now, you had Michael Howard as your tutor, who is by training an inclination historian. But Alistair Bacon, on the other hand, you could argue was really more on the philosophical and abstract side.
Yes, I mean, I would have thought, we would have thought, that Alistair was a bit too theoretical. Michael Howard was very much more practical, I think.
He'd had experience himself, hadn't he?
Yes, yes. He's a very strange man, Alistair Buchan, but he did have a great entree to people who were very valuable to get here, get to the RCDS. He had a great many friends around the place. And he obviously thought he could improve the quality of the academic thinking of senior officers, and I think to some extent he did.
You did say that he rubbed some people up the wrong way with his initial approach. Did the students manage to overcome that initial resentment?
Well, I think he was very silly, and of course one's heard of these sort of things happen before on the approach to people. I mean, there is, you can always, in any person taking over command, you've either got to have, come on chaps, help me approach, or you've got to say, you know, I'm the master, now you listen to me. I mean, Mrs. Thatcher started on the 2nd when she first took power, and she had all the permanent secretaries up in arms because she treated them like congenital idiots. And I think that the approach of Alistair Buchan would be to say, I'm greatly honoured to be here, and I'm very, very interested in your profession. I think I can bring something to this, and I want your help, really, to try to bring a widening of the perspective of the course. To my mind, everyone would have then absolutely bent over backwards to support him. But the approach, which I think he later regretted, that, you know, you are all absolute idiots, and I'm going to show you how stupid you all are, wasn't actually the right way to make friends and influence people. And he didn't actually believe that. I mean, he had a secret ambition to be a high military ranking officer himself, I think.
He left it a bit late, though.
Yeah, he did, that's right. Mm. But we had some very nice military instructors under him. A very, very good soldier who sadly died in Ireland of a heart attack. He was a guardsman. Do you remember? He went to be commander in Ulster.
Not Harry Tuzo.
No, before Harry Tuzo brought in because this chap had died. Erskine Crum.
Erskine Crum.
Mm. And it was very interesting, and you met lots of interesting people in the Foreign Office. Teddy Ude, who was later governor of Hong Kong, was a fellow student of mine. Robson, who was the deputy secretary of the army, was another student at that same time.
It sounds like the way Alistair Buchan behaved runs absolutely contrary to your notion of leadership, the green jacket way. Now, was that written as a result of your personal experience as a battalion commander?
Well, I think it was written when I was a battalion commander, but not so much of my personal experience when I was a battalion commander, more remembering what it had been like as a company commander, as a platoon commander, and all of my earlier service. I mean, there was this tremendous feeling that these young officers arrived from Sandhurst, I think increasingly taught about leadership and so on, but, you know, not actually knowing what they were supposed to do, and really waiting to make their first howling mistake and then trying to learn from the way their superior officer dealt with that mistake, either giving them a frightful rocket or saying, well, you learn by the mistakes, or say you'll do it this way, or some of the more characters of men of few words really would, you know, let you work it out for yourself. And I just thought that people wanted a little bit more guidance about what it was they were supposed to do. You see, the British Army is very difficult, because when you're a platoon commander, are you the boss? Are you the complete boss? What about your platoon sergeant? Is he, you know, is he 100% under you, or do you somehow, is he there to teach you in some way? I think it's very difficult to know quite how your attitude should be to senior NCOs. I mean, one of the things at Sandhurst, the senior NCOs have been lording it over you while you've been a cadet. Absolutely. You know, the idea that you could tick the Academy Sergeant Major off was very far-fetched. I thought they wanted a little bit more guidance, and that's why I wrote it.
Certainly, ticking the Academy Sergeant Major off is something the Commandant wouldn't care to do.
Well, that's right.
But
I mean, all this is part of education. I mean, I think I said very early on the sort of things that I'd learnt when I was a Lance Corporal, a rifleman. I mean, all these things have somehow been put at the back of one's mind, and one uses them for experience at other times.
Does it not all depend upon two things? One, the relative power of personality, and two, the actual circumstances in which you actually join your platoon?
Well, I think it does depend, of course, yes. I mean, I think it depends, you're quite right, on both these things. Of course, if to join the platoon, say, just after a platoon has been in a battle or something like that, is a very testing thing for a platoon commander. The personality, that is true, but then the personality, you know, needs a bit of time before it can start throwing its weight around. It's got to get the feel of the thing, and therefore it's got to have some clear idea of what it's trying to do, I think. Then you use your personality in achieving that.
Now, in 1971, you went off to become GOC of the 1st Division of the British Army of the Rhine. What sort of briefing did you have before you went out to take up command?
Well, it was a rather interesting situation, because unlike many of my contemporaries, I'd hardly ever served in Germany. I'd been in Germany and Northwest Europe during the war, and as you know, I'd finished the war in Hamburg and then went up into Denmark. And I'd been second in command of my battalion in Berlin about the time the war was going up, 1962. But apart from that, I'd never served in Germany. So the first time that I'd come back to Germany, really, since the end of the war, because you can't count Berlin, I was come to command a division, so I had a great deal to learn in the way of cries and the various things that people who'd served in Germany took as a matter of course, and I had to discover the geography of the places and find out about the training area, so there was quite a lot to absorb. At the same time, I'd always been tremendously interested in tactics. I had studied tactics and I experienced them, of course, in the war, in an armoured formation, and so command of an armoured division I found very, very interesting indeed, and I had quite strong ideas of how it should be handled in the circumstances we found ourselves in. I don't think I got any particular briefing, and really not very much direction. My corps commander was a very great friend of mine, Rowley Gibbs, who became CGS and Field Marshal. I don't think he ever gave me any direction. Serving under him was always a very congenial business. If I ever did receive a letter from him, it was on usually some subject like the wedding of Princess Anne and Mark Phillips, who the latter happened to be serving in my division at the time. So we were really on our own. The three divisional commanders, we got together, and Corps Commander, of course, approved what we did. And I had very strong ideas of what the division ought to do. I thought the name of the game, we didn't have very many resources, was deterrent. I thought we had got to be able to produce to the Russians and the Warsaw Pact an unacceptable choice, and that is that if they attacked us, they couldn't put their hand in the till and get away with it. There would be resistance. The whole of the forces of NATO would come into play, and within a reasonably short time they would have to expect nuclear weapons being used in some shape or form. And I felt, provided that we could realistically hold our own for a few days, this would be a choice that the Russians would not be prepared to accept. If they could, of course, gone through us like a knife with butter and achieved everything before anyone could take a decision about nuclear weapons, they might have thought it was worth having a go. But my job was not to win the war. My job was not to counterattack and march on Warsaw or Moscow. My job was to put up enough resistance to make it clear that there would be time for politicians to make an informed decision on nuclear weapons.
Did you have any clear idea about how long you could hold out for in the event?
Yes, I did, and I don't think it matters now saying this at all. I mean, for one reason and another, I reckoned that we would have run out of something, ammunition, space, ideas, whatever, people, in about 5 days. And my job was to put up a hell of a resistance for about 5 days and to give the impression to the Russians that I could put up a hell of a resistance for 5 days.
And what would your overall concept of operations have been for that resistance?
Well, we came at a time when I think tactical thinking was a little bit vague. We were being drawn forward, which was not unreasonable, into a position of forward defence, because the Germans were getting an increasing say in all this, and of course they didn't want to give up large amounts of German territory. At the same time, with the sort of strengths we had, we would have been destroyed in situ if we had gone for a linear defence along the inner German border. And so we were determined that we were going to use our skill on the ground, which we knew well, to fight a mobile defence, which had been so successful in various places in World War II. And we kept our troops in hides. We had light forces covering the front. which would indicate exactly the direction of the enemy, we would try to indicate these, we would try to channel these mass attacks into certain directions, and then we would come out of our hides into concealed positions where we could produce a great deal of havoc on these massed tank formations which we were going to expect against us, and hopefully disrupt them very considerably, both by means of our tank anti-tank fire from our tanks and anti-tank weapons from artillery and from our air, and we would then use the ground to go back and do it a little further back somewhere else. And in that way, we hope to take the steam out of his first echelon. And we were relying, of course, on the Air Force and other means to deal with his second echelon before they could get into the battle. And this is the way we hope to produce attrition in those first 5 days and make him realize that he either had to withdraw or find himself in a nuclear war.
What was the ground like in your sector?
Well, it was pretty flat. Of course, we were on the North German plain, but we had it was dotted, this flatness was dotted with an enormous numbers of villages and woods. And these, of course, provided the focal point of our defence, firing in defilade.